Our passage for today is from 1 Kings and chapter 19 and verse 1 through 18. So 1 Kings chapter 19 and verse 1 through 18. Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah, saying, "So may the gods do to me and more also, if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by this time tomorrow." Then he was afraid, and he arose and ran for his life and came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a broom tree. And he asked that he might die, saying, "It is enough. Now, O Lord, take away my life, for I am no better than my father's." And he lay down and slept under a broom tree. And behold, an angel touched him and said to him, "Arise and eat." And he looked, and behold, there was at his head a cake baked on hot stones, a jar of water. And he ate and drank and lay down again. And the angel of the Lord came again a second time and touched him and said, "Arise and eat, for the journey is too great for you." And he arose and ate and drank and went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to Oreb, the mount of God. There he came to a cave and lodged in it. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He said, "I have been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts. For the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. And I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away." And he said, "Go out and stand on the mount before the Lord." And behold, the Lord passed by, and a great and strong wind tore the mountains and broke in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, the sound of a low whisper. And when Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his cloak and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. And behold, there came a voice to him and said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He said, "I have been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. And I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away." And the Lord said to him, "Go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus. And when you arrive, you shall anoint Hazael to be king over Syria. And Jehu, the son of Nimshi, you shall anoint to be king over Israel. And Elisha, the son of Shaphat, of Abel-Meholah, you shall anoint to be prophet in your place. And the one who escapes from the sword of Hazael shall Jehu put to death. And the one who escapes from the sword of Jehu shall Elisha put to death. Yet I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him." Word of the Lord. Imagine, if you will, and perhaps you don't have to imagine, that you have reached the pinnacle of your career, the top of your graduating class. Maybe you're an accomplished writer or musician, artist, or maybe you're just a really good brother or sister, right? You got your sibling the perfect gift. You said the right words at the right time, and everything's just hugs and thank yous. But the next day, no one seems to acknowledge that you're the best brother or sister. Right? Or maybe you're just nailing it as a mom or dad. You've got the butt wiping business down to a science. You're like a McDonald's worker pumping out burgers, or an Ajumma pumping out gimbaps, but instead a neatly diapered, clean child. But the next day, it's like a horror or end times movie, and your patience is shot, and you're pretty sure you're the worst. Well, something like that happens to the prophet Elijah. He has this great contest on the mountain, and it's like he's in the boxing ring with the prophets of Baal. And he's throwing out this knockout punch, and everyone's mobbing him and giving him high fives and congratulations. And you expect that the next day is going to be pretty good too. But the next day, he's on the run. It seems the world had not received or accepted that definitive win. So our story today is on the other side of a great victory. When the world does not seem to respond as Elijah or perhaps we expect. And all the questions that kind of come with that experience. Before we do that though, let's catch up. So last week, we were there for the anointing of King David by the prophet and priest Samuel. And after the rule of King David's son, Solomon, the kingdom of Israel splits into two. The northern kingdom retains the name of Israel, and the southern kingdom goes by Judah. And our story today happens principally in the northern kingdom, which is, of the two, the most unfaithful. And the king at that time is a man, King Ahab, and he's particularly wicked. And he compounds that wickedness by marrying Jezebel, a woman from Sidon, that is, a foreigner. And she brings with her the worship of the storm god Baal and a host of all his prophets. And as she says in our passage, she actively goes after prophets of God. The prophet of that day is a man named Elijah. And Elijah's ministry happens primarily during this drought of rain imposed by God for Israel's idolatry and disobedience. And Elijah's prayer seems to control the weather, like someone just like turning on or off the faucet. In the New Testament, James points to Elijah as an example of great faith, but possible faith too. He says, "The prayer of a righteous person has great power as it is working." Elijah was a man with a nature like ours, and he prayed fervently that it might not rain. And for 3 years and 6 months, it did not rain on the earth. Then he prayed again, and heaven gave rain, and the earth bore its fruit. So this model of faith. And last year, we met Elijah when he went to a foreign woman's house during this drought and asked for her last bit of flour and oil. And God miraculously provides for him and the woman, though her son dies. And Elijah prays on behalf of him, and he's brought back to life. And this foreign woman ends up confessing God and praising Elijah as a man of God. Again, this man of faith. Now, immediately after that, we have this big showdown on the mountain that I talked about between Elijah and the prophets of Baal. And the showdown is this, over which God will show up and consume a sacrifice with fire. Will Baal show up, or the God of Israel? The prophets of Baal try desperately to get their God to show up. And they're even like cutting themselves. It's a kind of a gruesome display, but nothing. It says in verse 29 of chapter 18, there was no voice, no one answered, no one paid attention. It's like three times, nothing. Elijah even gets into it and starts to mock them. And he says, "Cry aloud, for he is a God, Either he is musing, or he is relieving himself, or he is on a journey, or perhaps he is asleep and must be awakened. But the God of Israel shows up in full force with fire consuming the offering. Likewise, that drought, Elijah prays, and God sends rain and wind. It's a dramatic and stunning victory. And Elijah is full of confidence. Like when you pass that big test or finish a race or have that great day of parenting, right? And you just have that confidence, like, okay, what's next, life? Bring it on, right? But in our passage today, that confidence quickly goes away. A death sentence is passed on him by Queen Jezebel. And it sends him running away from that site of great victory in the opposite direction. So Mount Carmel is the mountain where this victory happened, and it's in the north. And Elijah turns around and heads to the south and goes beyond Beersheba, which is one of the last villages to the south. It'd be like if you were in Seoul and then you made a beeline for Busan. He actually goes beyond that, though. He leaves Israel completely and goes to Mount Oreb, which is another name for Mount Sinai, same place where God made his covenant with Israel through Moses, where the Ten Commandments were made. It's God's mountain. And there, Elijah is told to ready himself to meet God. A great wind goes by, but we're told the Lord was not in the wind. Likewise, the earth quakes and a great fire comes through. But again, God is not in either. Remember, Elijah had just seen the sacrifice consumed by fire. And he prayed for rain and wind. And he saw it happen. But for our sake and Elijah's, we are told that God is not in these elements. And God is sovereign over nature, but he's not one and the same with it. These are the means by which God may act, but we shouldn't confuse the means with the subject of the actions. God then provides instructions to anoint a new king over Israel rather than King Ahab, and a new prophet, Elisha, instead of Elijah, and a new king over the foreign country of Syria. So God is over creation, as we said, but he's also over the nations. He's not just the God of Israel, he's the God of the world. And if he appoints a king for Syria, that person will be the king. He's not bound by the territory of Israel. And likewise, to Elijah's plea that he's all by himself, God says, no, actually, I've spared 7,000 in Israel who have not worshipped Baal. So Elijah's view of the world is lifted, and he sees things from God's point of view. As great a figure as Elijah is, and that he's a model of faith, he too is learning that God is even bigger than he imagined. And he had that time on the mountain, and he thought, this is who God is. And then he finds out God's even bigger than that. That he's over creation and over the nations. Elijah has his part to play, but if he thinks he's alone, if he thinks he's the sum of God's plan, he's kidding himself. And so are we, if we think we're alone in God's plan. Now, the God we love is sovereign over all creation. We read Elijah's taunt of Baal. Maybe he's away on a journey. Right? Maybe he went to the bathroom. Right? Back then, you identified a god directly with rain or fire or an element of nature. So if that element was gone, that meant the god was perhaps gone too. And so you would sacrifice to bring the god back. But the God of Israel is not identified with the rain. He's sovereign over creation. He declares the drought, and he brings the rain back. Right? It's not two rival gods duking it out. He provides the drought and he provides the rain. In another place, we read about God's sovereignty like this. The Lord kills and brings to life. He brings down to Sheol, that's the place of the dead, and raises up. The Lord makes poor and makes rich. He brings low and exalts. That's from 1 Samuel. We may not, like people of old, worship idols in a temple, though if you've explored Asia, maybe you've seen some of that. But we often identify God with one thing and not another. For example, we might identify God with material blessing. Right? Now, of course, God blesses, and sometimes materially. Right? God likes earth, trees and rivers and food and housing, right? God likes matter. He created it. So he's still in the business of doing that. But if we identify God with that blessing directly, what happens when we don't experience God's blessing? Does that mean, like Elijah mocks, that God is away on a journey? I know. The man Job is able to say, and sometimes we sing, the Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Likewise, in both of my Bible studies, we're going through the book of Philippians, and Paul writes from prison. And by all appearances, prison would mean the absence of God, right? Something has gone wrong if you're in prison. And who would sign up for that anyways? But no, Paul says, reviewing his time in prison and the way in which the gospel has spread, he says that he rejoices, right? Even though he's in prison. I had lunch with one of the Korean pastors a while ago, and he had gone on a trip to London for an evangelism conference. And then recently, he had come back from a mission trip to from Burundi, one of the poorest countries in the world. So London first, and then Burundi. And the contrast was as striking as it could be. But he said that the Christians in Burundi were filled with a joy that he had not seen before, even though they were poor. And he could not find that joy in London, and he couldn't find it in Korea, at least not to that degree. And it made him pause. Up till then, whenever he went abroad to preach, he would tell the story of Korea, that it was once poor, but then it accepted the gospel, and then it became prosperous, right? So poor, gospel, and then prosperity. And this is the story he told often. And it's a good one, right? It's a compelling one. But after seeing the Christians in Burundi, he felt that that account of Korea was far too simple. He's not sure that he has understood blessing correctly. The Christians in Burundi did not define God by the presence of material blessing. Though I'm sure, of course, they would welcome it if it came, right? All things come from God. But they did not consider God to be absent because they were poor. Again, God is sovereign over life and death, wealth and poverty, drought and rain. He sends the wind, but he is not in the wind. That is the God that we love, who's sovereign over creation. What does our passage say about the neighbor that we love? First, that we have neighbors. We're not alone, right? If you have been called by God, you too may feel at times like Elijah. He says, I have been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, and I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away. Our calling, whatever it might be, is part of God's larger plan. remember, I don't know if you can for this far back, but when we started in Genesis, God gave humanity a little bit of power, a little bit of sovereignty in creation, to be his kind of junior partners in creation. But the junior is important there. And Elijah starts to forget this. He thinks he's the only one. But as God reveals, like, well, I'm going to appoint this king, a prophet over here, and I've got 7,000 over here who have not worshipped Baal. God is working, and we can't see everything. I was reading the book of Esther recently, and you've likely heard the sort of bumper sticker verse that goes like this: who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this? And that's a good verse, right? But if you read, actually within that same verse, any of the ego gets drained away. It begins like this: if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place. That is, Esther has been given the opportunity to partake in God's plan. But if she refuses, God will still deliver them. He's got his plan, and we are privileged to participate. But yes, he can do things his way and through other means. So we have neighbors. We have other people that God can work with. He will find someone else. Elijah wasn't alone, and we aren't alone. God chooses to work through humanity, but his plan will go forward, with or without. But we can also encourage those who are like Elijah in a time of crisis during their calling, reminding them of God's sovereignty and that, you know, the weight of the world is not on their shoulders. God's plan is above their view of life and their ministry. Lastly, where is the gospel in our story? Right. After a great victory over Baal and his prophets, Elijah is on the run. Right. That high he sort of received on Mount Carmel quickly turns to fear. And likewise, after the cross, after Jesus' death and resurrection, it may come to us as a surprise that we are on the run, that the world doesn't simply kind of turn into a paradise. Right? Like, why do I have to go to work if Jesus raised from the dead? Right? Or more seriously, the Jezebels of one kind or another are still around chasing down God's people. Right? What's going on? We need a larger view of our present situation, just like Elijah, right? Elijah literally goes up a mountain and gets a better view, right? In Revelation, we see this big battle in the heavens. Again, John is lifted up into the heavens. He gets another view. And this battle, it's God's angels against Satan. Michael, the archangel, is leading the fight. And Satan is defeated and thrown down from heaven to earth. And we read that Satan went off to make war on those who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. If you've ever been around a mortally wounded animal, you know to stay kind of clear of them, right? At that point, they're out for survival, and they're likely to lash out at anyone who gets near them. In the same way, Satan has been fatally wounded by Christ. And so he stomps around the world making trouble, knowing that his time is short. But if you do not have that perspective, then you would be like Elijah, wondering, you know, what in the world is going on here? Why am I getting beat up? Why isn't the world an easy place? But when we see things in light of the gospel, that Satan has been thrown down, we are able to endure, knowing that Satan's, the veracity of Satan, is actually a sign of panic on his part, because he sees the clock and he knows his time is almost up. So, remember, God is bigger than our expectations of him. Right? He's bigger than our experience of him. He gives life and he takes it away. He brings drought and he brings rain. And encourage one another. Right? You are not alone in your calling, whatever it might be. And God's plan will go forward. And recall that when we suffer on account of Christ, it actually points to the mortal blow that Jesus gave to Satan on the cross. It's actually a sign of salvation, not the absence of it. Let's pray.